their clients.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the fourth case, Livingston Johnson versus Holder. Mr. Gerber?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
If you need to make a stop there, that's fine.
I think I may be able to handle it all right here. If I may, Your Honor. My name is Malcolm Gerber. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, respondent in removal proceedings, Livingston Rondo Johnson. Judge, there's a lot of issues here. This court is possessed of the jurisdiction to adjudicate this matter as to a constitutional claims and as to questions of law. That the questions are of impermissible retroactivity are reviewed de novo, and this honorable court had ruled on a previously filed motion to dismiss the petition, which was denied. Since the briefs have been filed in this cause, we've had a little bit of a surprise at the United States Supreme Court, I believe, with Padilla, which indicates that in addition to defense counsels having a duty to advise non-citizen clients as to their immigration circumstances or liability, the court also indicated that immigration issues are no longer to be considered collateral in removal proceedings, which is a substantial change in the previous law. With respect to this matter, Mr. Johnson is an LPR and had been in the United States for a period of close to 30 years. Yes, he did have one single law enforcement contact which resulted in this conviction. However, at the time the conviction was entered, he had relief available to him should he have been charged by the government. The government did not charge him until the year 2006 from a conviction that occurred in 1992. He was under the radar. They did not pick him up after registration requirements under the Predators Act in Operation Predator. They bypassed him. His deportation proceedings commenced when he filed his second application for naturalization. They denied it on the basis of a lack of good moral character, the 92 conviction, and then proceeded to charge him as a removable alien under the new provisions of the law that went into full force and effect on September the 30th of 1996, 4 years after his conviction.
He was under the radar, if you put it. What was his status?
As a lawful permanent resident, Your Honor.
And so it's when he went to get naturalized, he alerted them to what had happened in the past.
Right, but definitely.
So you think that just the lapse of time should take him off the hook?
Judge, you know, I really don't know. I think he believed that he did have the ability, or if you will, eligible for naturalization. I did not represent him. It could have ranged anything from, well, they've never bothered me, so maybe they don't think that this is of any consequence. There were two applications. The administrative record will show two applications for naturalization. First one was denied by the service for the exact same reason, and they never pursued it any further.
Mr. Gerber?
Yes.
As you know, you run into trouble here with the limitations that have been imposed on the Supreme Court's decision in St. Cyr. In this court, you seem to be relying in part on the Third Circuit's different interpretation, broader interpretation of St. Cyr, where somebody who went to trial was allowed to take advantage of the pre-96 law.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I understood that case correctly, and I'm referring to Panapula against Ashcroft, in that case there was actual evidence that the government had offered a plea to a misdemeanor that in essence would have avoided this kind of problem. And so there was evidence of reliance on the prior status of the law. In this case, do you have evidence that Mr. Johnson ever actually relied upon the state of the law in 1992 when he went to trial?
Judge, I do not. I have no specific evidence as to whether or not that he did or whether or not he even discussed it. To be perfectly honest with you. However, the Panapula, the case here is one where they looked at the language of the Act. The Act does not distinguish between a conviction of one kind or a conviction of another. It just says a conviction. And they found, I believe, that, yes, the individual who was convicted previously where there was relief available should be permitted to pursue that. But here, in this court, decided Zamora, Mallory, 1 week after that, and Zamora Mallory supported the language of the BIA in Blake. 1 week after that, subsequent to the remand of Blake from the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, the BIA says DHS seems to think that this is also a crime involving moral turpitude and sends it back down to the immigration judge for a 212C hearing. That's all my client wants. All we want is to be able to present evidence to the immigration judge that he warrants discretionary relief. That's the sole underlying major issue here, besides the other ones. But the BIA has basically said, well, we don't really think our decision in Blake is so, you know, there is a crime involving moral turpitude. The subject matter has been briefed. There's a very long history that the offenses, inappropriate contact with minor children, is in fact and always has been a crime involving moral turpitude. Congress in 96, when they drastically expanded the definitions of offenses, that it became known as aggravated felonies. Before, in 1990, the aggravated felony definition was murder, was trafficking in controlled substances, and trafficking in firearms. And that was it. 6 years later, boom, the world exploded. And there was a reliance on that with respect to the specific conduct of cases. The man was a CMIT. Apparently he must have relied on it because he attempted to apply for naturalization, believing that he established that he had been rehabilitated. I noticed that I'm being warned that my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. McGay?
May it please the Court, Sherry Begay on behalf of the Attorney General. The petitioner in this case was ordered removed as an aggravated felon, and accordingly, this court's jurisdiction is limited to only questions of law and constitutional claims. The issues that petitioner raises in his brief, however, are foreclosed by statute or this Court's precedent and accordingly don't overcome the bar to judicial review. And therefore, the Court should dismiss the petition for review in this case. In his opening brief, Mr. Johnson argues that the repeal of Section 212C would be impermissibly retroactive as applied to him because he relied on the availability of that relief. But the Court does not even need to address that argument because petitioner would still be ineligible for such relief because the aggravated felony ground for which he was found removable has no statutory counterpart in 212A. Specifically, petitioner's offense in this case is identical to the offense committed in matter of Blake. In that case, the Department of Homeland Security charged Blake with deportability based on an aggravated felony conviction for sexual abuse of a minor. Blake sought a Section 212C waiver, and the board held that he did not qualify for that waiver. And the reasoning was that the aggravated felony ground of sexual abuse of a minor does not have a statutory counterpart in Section 212A. And further, the board in that case expressly rejected the argument that the comparability test was satisfied because the offense of sexual abuse of a minor could be characterized as a crime involving moral turpitude. Numerous circuits, including this one, have followed the board's approach in Blake. Specifically, in Zamora-Mallari, this court affirmed the board's decision and agreed with the board's formulation of the comparable grounds test, which focuses on the actual grounds on which an alien is found to be removable and not the possible grounds. And in this case, petitioner was charged with removability because his offense constituted an aggravated felony and not because he was convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. Therefore, petitioner's claim that he is eligible for a 212C waiver under the crime involving moral turpitude category has no merit. Given that petitioner's offense does not have a comparable ground of inadmissibility, he is not eligible for 212C waiver on this basis. And the court, therefore, does not even need to reach his reliance argument in this case. Finally, petitioner argues that the board erred in finding him ineligible for a Section 212H waiver, but the plain language of the statute expressly provides that no waiver shall be granted to a lawful permanent resident who's been convicted of an aggravated felony, as the petitioner has in this case. Finally, because petitioner has not raised any other issues in this case that would overcome the bar to judicial review, the court should accordingly dismiss the petition for review.
Ms. Begay, can I ask, do you think we've got jurisdiction here?
Specifically with regard to the aggravated felony finding, is that your question, Your Honor?
Or with regard to the relief being sought.
With regard to relief being sought?
I understood your brief to be arguing that we don't have jurisdiction.
Well, specifically in the brief, we are arguing that none of the issues that have been raised are any issues that would invoke the court's jurisdiction because they're all foreclosed by statute or the court's precedent.
Okay,
they're not.
My question, I guess, would be, given the different view of the Third Circuit, would this claim, in your view, would the Third Circuit have jurisdiction over such a claim?
The Third Circuit, if it was raised in the Third Circuit, he would possibly be raising arguments that were not foreclosed by that.
I understand you're arguing that he should still lose, but would you agree that in the Third Circuit, these arguments would have jurisdiction?
Possibly the court may have jurisdiction.
How about the Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm. Under the Supreme Court's decision in St. Cyr, he would still be ineligible. So.
Well, I understand you think he loses on the merits, but why wouldn't the Supreme Court have jurisdiction to hear an argument about the expansion, in essence, of the holding in St. Cyr to folks who went to trial in reliance upon the state of the law prior to 1996?
Well, even in this case, with regard to his reliance argument, he would lose,
Do you understand the distinction I'm trying to draw?
Yes.
Between the merits and subject matter jurisdiction
yes.
here? And what I'm trying to understand is why you are arguing that we don't have jurisdiction.
Well, the arguments that we raised with regard to jurisdiction were only with regard to his particular case here. I mean, he has not, I again go back to his arguments that he's raised. He loses on his arguments, clearly.
On the merits.
On the merits. And this, he's been convicted of an aggravated felony, so he, again, is only limited to...
So would you agree that we have jurisdiction to consider these arguments?
These arguments, yes. The court would have jurisdiction.
Ms. Gerber? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Really quickly, constitutionally, if my client lived in Philadelphia, I wouldn't have a problem. We would have gotten our opportunity to present our case to the immigration judge for discretionary relief. As to the history that we're confronted with this, St. Cyr said that, no, you can't take these new definitions or the effect of the new definitions of the 96 Act and apply it to this class of individuals who had pled guilty. Therefore,
if you wait 12 years to apply for the naturalization,
yes, Your Honor,
is it fair to say you may bear the risk of a change in the law?
There can always be a change in the law.
Yes, I understand. He went to trial here. He didn't.
Yes,
so there was no bargain with Mr. Gerber with the government, right?
Well, I would assume that probably there was an offer made and it was rejected. I don't have that to present as a matter of record here. However, with respect to, the Immigration Act itself, well, there is no classification and the law changed substantially. But you are required to establish a period of 5 years of good moral character immediately preceding the filing of an application for naturalization.
He had to get to, 97, I guess.
He had to go to, from the date that the conviction, that the sentence had been completed, there was a 30-month probationary sentence. No jail time, straight probation. So he had to wait that. Then an additional 5 years has been to practice because they're not going to give you Nats while you're doing a probationary sentence. So the time really, okay, it was a little extra time, but he wanted to show that, in fact, he was a good, it's just that with the decision of the board, the final order in Blake has a bearing here as to how the board felt about Blake. And as far as comparison is concerned, there's more than just overlap. There are eons, since 52 cases, to the effect that the offense is a CMIT. And they sent Blake back to the judge for a hearing under 212C. I believe my client should be given the same opportunity. I believe that it is required under the Constitution. I thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Thank you, Ms. McGay. The case is taken under advisement.